At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, everybody. I'm so excited to finally be speaking with Dr. Daria Long Gillespie. Dr. Daria and I have known each other for many years now. We first met when I was working in television, but really have become closer over the last year as I started Smarter News. And I can't thank you enough, Dr. Daria, because you have been there from the beginning.
Yay! Yay, Smarter News!
Yes. So thank you so much on a professional level and a personal level as well. And actually, when we were talking, way back when Smarter News was launching, you were telling me about the book Mom Hacks. So I have a bunch of questions about your new book that just came out that we're really excited about. But today I was thinking as I was driving, I was thinking, you know, I've never really asked Dr. Daria why she became a doctor. Like I don't really know that part of your story. So tell us a little bit about what brought you to medicine in the first place.
We're like going way
back.
Yeah,
let's go here, back.
Aren't we? Okay. Yeah. So I became a doctor, I think, for two reasons. One, I really liked what I saw and the ability to take people when they were at their worst and feeling scared and in pain and being able to offer them something like, you know, you've come to the right place. I'm going to help you. I can make this better. And I also realized somewhere along the way that when there were emergencies that most people were running away from, I was like running to them to like try to go help and do something. And I thought everybody did that. And then I realized that, no, that's an unusual thing that, you know, I like those moments when everything's, all hell is breaking loose. I feel like that's when I can act my best. So that's why I became an ER doctor.
And that's why you became a mother.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. So wait a minute. So how long did you spend as a practicing ER doctor?
So many years. So I finished residency in 2011.
Got it.
So I finished medical school back in 2006 and then did 5 years of residency. So,
okay. So we're going to fast forward through that point. I'm sure you saw a lot of really interesting things in the ER that can apply actually probably to some of the questions that we got from Smarter News readers and watchers and listeners. But why did you decide, okay, now's the right time. I'm going to write this book, Mom Hacks. Mm-hmm. Like, where did the idea for the book come from?
So the idea for the book, Jenna, came because as an ER doctor, I always felt that no matter what comes in those double doors, I could handle it, whether it was a woman in labor or a heart attack or somebody with a car accident, and that I've got this. But then I became a mom, and I did not feel like I've got this remotely. And I looked around at some of my mom friends and my patients who are moms, and we didn't feel that way. And so I started to look at, you know, what is it about my work as an ER doctor and lessons that I learned when I had developed arthritis? What did I learn there? How can I transfer all of that to create a system so that I and moms every single day can feel like I've got this?
That's amazing. And, you know, I'm just remembering now your story about having arthritis and having to overcome, you know, here you are really active, a runner, doing all sorts of things. And then suddenly like, that changed for you as well. Mm-hmm. So that must have been a really interesting experience to not only have the experience as a doctor, but also as a mom. And then as someone who also has experienced some health setbacks and sort of funnel that towards this project.
It was. And when, Jenna, as you said, I went from running every single day to being unable to just stand to talk to my patients. I had to, you know, pull up a chair, or if not, there wasn't a chair, I was sitting on a garbage can. And so I was in pain and I had a lot of fear, and I was told that this is the way it's going to be. So that when I became, and so again, I fought against that and I made major changes so that when I heard those same kind of messages when I was pregnant, that this is the way your health is going to be as a mom. And when I felt some of that fear, I was like, you know what? I fixed this once before, and the reality is I had access to resources, so I knew I didn't have to believe that. And so I wrote this book for every other woman so that she also knows that she doesn't have to believe that either.
And by the way, I mean, we're just getting a little bit of a slice of why the book is so great, because you tell some great personal stories, some of which sound devastating at the time, but also slightly hilarious when you retell them, which I appreciate, which we need a sense of humor. And it's just filled with, like, you could pick up the book and you could read a little bit of it and have get a great value of information. So mm-hmm. I really encourage anyone out there, you know, whether you're a parent or not a parent, like, it's a great book to check out. It's a great book to have in your bookshelf. And it's a fun read, which we all need.
Thank you.
It's really a fun read. Yeah, I really love it. So let me ask you, I asked our Smarter News folks for some questions, some health questions, but I do want to ask you about a story that happened this week that just sort of broke over the last 24 hours, because our audience has been really engaged about this measles outbreak that we've been covering in general and this debate about vaccinations. And we're not going to get into the debate about vaccinations now. It's a big topic. It deserves to be unpacked thoughtfully and with mm-hmm. all sides represented. But there was a statement made, and one of the things we reviewed is that mainly our requirements for vaccinations are at a state level. They're not at a federal level. Like, the federal government, Uncle Sam doesn't tell us what vaccinations we mm-hmm. want. And now states are really sort of self-reflecting and wondering, well, wait a minute, should we give these exemptions? You know, for example, mm-hmm. 17 states give personal exemptions for vaccines. Should they do that? And this is happening in Washington state, where there is this measles outbreak and a high level of unvaccinated children. So now the government is now kind of floating the idea, well, maybe we should have federal requirements of some sort. Mm-hmm. Maybe there should be something stricter coming from the central government. And I'm just sort of curious your thoughts about that as a doctor, like, practically speaking, but also do you think we should reverse course and suddenly do that? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a really good question, Jenna. I think sometimes there are things that should be decided by states, especially when the state may have different demographics, different financials, and things that could be different and have different responses per state. The reality is measles doesn't care if you're a red state or a blue state, or if you have a high socioeconomic class or a low one. It doesn't care. If you're in a room with somebody who has measles and you're not vaccinated, you have a 95% chance of catching it. It is that contagious. Many of these diseases are the same way. So this is one, and I often, like, will refrain from saying the federal government to do this, but I think it does make sense that since it is universal to everybody, it would make sense potentially to have a single federal government ruling for a lot of these vaccinations.
And by the way, we have no idea what that would look like or how that would be applied practically. But it's sort of interesting that this is the way the conversation is going, because for so many years it kind of went the opposite conversation.
Right.
This is how news goes. I'm sure it's like,
of course,
too. It goes back and forth.
Pendulum.
Right?
And it could be, if the states want to do it themselves, that's fine too. I just think we're realizing now the effect of all of these exemptions. We're realizing the reality is measles, when I was in medical school, I mean, not that long ago, we thought that measles was something that we didn't really have to learn about. It was like measles, polio, you know, the plague, not really something that I'm going to have to take care of with patients. And now these diseases are coming back because we kind of got a little nonchalant about them because we hadn't seen them. And so we're seeing them come back and realizing, wow, these are serious diseases. People die from them. We have something that we know prevents them. So whether it's state level or federal level, I, as a physician and a mom, I just want to see people stay safe and be vaccinated.
Got it. Well, that's really interesting. Thank you for that. Because it was something that I saw. I was like, wow, I really haven't seen that before. And, you know, we'll see. Okay. Yeah. So let me get to some of the questions from our audience. Joe actually had a great question. And this is what I think a lot of parents confront, but also grandparents. She's asking this: what can be done for extremely overweight children? My granddaughter is only 12 years old, but extremely overweight. It's a huge health concern for me. What can I do to help her and her parents get her back on the right track?
This is so hard. I have moms ask, and grandmoms ask me this all the time. They're worried about the health of their munchkins that they may see that are having obesity. And we're seeing a rising rate of obesity in young kids that we never saw before. So I would say for most parents, there's kind of three things that I would have them do. Number one, easiest thing, is look at how much device time she's using. Because so many kids, they are replacing what used to be physical activity with device time. So look at that and limit it and say, you know, go do something else. Even if it's free play or reading or something, do that, because the devices, especially at night, also impact their sleep. And we know that if you just mess up somebody's sleep and you don't even change their diet, their cholesterol rises, that people are testing positive for prediabetes in studies where all they did was mess up their sleep. So devices, not only do they keep you from exercising, they can mess up your sleep. So no devices an hour or two before bed. Number two, just get her moving. And as the grandmother or mother, go with her. Can get her go on a walk. Something where, especially if she's feeling obese, she may feel a little bit self-conscious about her shape. Don't try to put her in soccer or something where she's going to feel insecure. Just go for a walk in a way that makes her feel good about her body. No body shaming. Don't even mention shape. Just say, let's go for a walk. We'll have more energy. And then lastly, I would say, look at her diet, specifically sugar. We know that sugar hits right at those same brain zones that we have addiction to drugs. It is like, and you get a quick hit of it, and it is hard to resist. So 74% of foods in the grocery store have added sugar, especially kids' foods. So I would say start looking at all of the sugar and her added sugar in foods and, you know, sugars like desserts and stuff. But if you remove the added sugar from her foods, studies have shown that just that alone also causes kids to lose weight.
Wow, that's really interesting. And that interesting part about sleep too. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's something you cover in your book about sleep and
deprivation. All of these. Yeah, oh my God. All of these, and even like the hidden sugar, because it's a lot more complicated. And so you can learn to look for, because the labeling is really behind. So it's hard to know what has hidden sugar in it. So there's a whole hack on cutting hidden sugar, how to read labels and things like that for somebody to use.
Okay, that's great, because I definitely need that 100%.
It's hard.
And by the way, I'll never forget, I was talking to my pediatrician. What, you know, I have a son and I have a daughter, and when my daughter was starting to eat, it was like she ate she's always been like that, you know, like she will eat anything. Like she is great. She's a great eater, right? And now she's getting more picky because she's 2.5. But I remember like talking to the pediatrician about it, being like, she just eats a lot, you know, like she's eating a lot. And the pediatrician said something to me like, don't talk about your daughter that way. And I was like, I'm not saying. I just
like I wasn't trying to.
I don't know. Is that going to affect her weight? Did she hear me? Like, she's a year old. I don't even know. But I remember, I mean, weight with kids is really tricky. And I really, you know, you got to watch what you say. You got to watch what you're giving them. I mean, it's this whole like parenthood thing. It's really hard.
Telling them like, don't say like, this is for your weight or because you're overweight. It's like, this is to make you feel better or have more energy or to do better in school or something along those lines, so they don't feel shamed and just role model it.
That's good advice too. This ties into, it's not necessarily part of what we're eating, but we've been told for so many years that we should take certain vitamins. And so I got a great question about vitamins. What is a good vitamin regime for a healthy, almost 40-year-old? It's so hard to navigate this with all the differing options. You know, what do you think about vitamins in general, Dr. Dari? Because I think there's a lot of different schools of thought about if they can help us or not.
You're absolutely right. So bottom line is there are no studies that show that taking vitamins really in pill form are best, unless you're truly deficient in something. There's nothing that shows that it's better in pill form than taking it in food. So number one, as I tell people, like, eat your vitamins. So, you know, go tell it, and I don't count my produce servings a day. Who has time for that? But every couple of days, I'll make like a great big smoothie or a great big salad. And if you do that, then you know, okay, I've got my veggie boost in. I'm getting enough. I do tell people it's a good idea to go to your doctor and kind of get some things checked. Vitamin B12, calcium, vitamin D. Studies are not entirely clear, but people tend to think that your vitamin D level should be somewhere between 60 to 90. And so go get that checked, because that may be something, especially since all of us wear sunscreen and we are not outside as much, a vitamin D supplement may be helpful. But again, just like iron as well, it's sort of thing. You don't want to just take it willy-nilly. There's a lot of questionnaires online. You can take a questionnaire and it can tell you. Really, nobody can know unless you get your blood checked. So talk to your doctor about that.
And it is a serious, it is blood work. It's like, it's a very specific blood work. It's not, right? I mean, I think
is specific. Exactly. Because like vitamin D, all of these things, vitamin D is great. But if you don't know your level and you just start taking mega doses, just like taking a mega dose of omega-3s, you take something that could be beneficial and now you've kind of made it potentially toxic. Okay. Because all of these things, our bodies store them. They can't always get rid of them.
That's okay. Because I know, especially in the wintertime, sometimes you're like, I'm feeling blue. I'm just going to take as much vitamin D as I possibly can take.
Yeah, he was like, what's the harm? I was like, was the vitamin D just a little medical school lesson? When your vitamin D levels are too high, your calcium can go up. You can get kidney stones. Like, it's not good. So all of these, check your levels.
Okay, that's good. Okay, this question, first of all, it either directly applies to all of us, or we have a friend that is exactly like this, who we sometimes don't want to be around. And I really appreciate her honesty. But she was one of the first people that wrote, and she says, I'm 38 with 3 kids, 5 months old, 2 years old, and 5. Mm-hmm. Whoa, first of all, whoa. She goes, I work from home, my older kids in preschool, and we're very busy. We're sick all the time. With either a cold virus or the flu or strep. how do we stay healthy? We are 100% up to date with every vaccine, flu included. Like what? I mean, I know this person. I am this person sometimes. But like, what do you do?
Oh my God. Well, little children, they're like little bioterrorists. But so here's what to do. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. So I hear you. So a couple different things. One, the minute they get home, especially during cold and flu season, I have them take off. Like they're standing in the bedroom. I have them take off their clothes and we wash their hands up to their elbows with soap.
So clothes too on that. I mean, that's really important to know. Like it can stuff be on their like pants or their shirts from.
It could be, you know, it's especially like you carry it home and you know, hand like doorknobs and elevator buttons are what keep it the most, but clothes too. So take off the clothes. It also lets them wash up to their elbows with water and soap. Many viruses are resistant to hand sanitizers. So use hand sanitizer. If you're out and you can't access water, a sanitizer is better than nothing, but really water and soap, warm water and soap is the best. So that's number one. Number two, watch your devices and your iPads. I mean, your kids, they rub their nose, they rub it on their iPad, they pass it to their sister. It's just like, hi, germ central. So all of those things, wash them really well. You know, just take some Clorox, wipe those down. When it's flu and cold season, I am that person that I do not press elevator buttons. I do not touch doorknobs. I use my elbow.
You're one of those.
So I'm not getting sick. Yeah, I'm like the weirdo. I don't care. Big hair, don't care. You know, so I use a paper towel on a doorknob. And I teach my kids to do that. I think it's a big deal. We know flu and all of those can just sit on all of those things. And like, how often are those really getting cleaned? So
never.
Another big one. So I think if you do those three things and teach your kids to do those, that makes a big difference. Also, a little bit of exercise. Studies show that if you exercise and get plenty of sunshine, like at least an hour a day of sunshine, your risk of getting the flu and cold is lower during the winter season. So a little bit of exercise and sunshine is good. Vitamin D.
That's so interesting because I know back, you know, when there were obviously major outbreaks in a city like New York, that's part of the reason of Central Park being developed because, you know, get the people out from the tenements, these places where they're sick and try to get them fresh air. And I thought that was an old wives tale, but it doesn't sound like that.
No. And studies have found that like, people who got more sunshine in August got fewer colds and flus in the winter. So it's about vitamin D and our immune system. There's a lot of around that. And exercising also keeps you healthier because it keeps the blood flowing. Your white blood cells are invigorated and ready to go to fight. Lastly, what I also do, if I feel a cold coming on, I don't do this with my kids, but with adults, if you're not taking other medications, I take zinc. So as soon as those cold symptoms come on, 50 milligrams of zinc twice a day for a couple of days with food, or it'll totally tear up your stomach. It has antiviral properties as well.
And do you like any particular brand? Do you like use Zicam? Isn't Zicam the one that had zinc in it? I don't know.
Zicam does. Yeah. No, I am not sponsored by any zinc brand. So Zicam, I actually just take a supplement. Zicam has a thing that goes in your nose. And I just take a pill. But again, take it with food.
So actually this is, this goes into my question and then we have one final one, but you know, my entire family right now we definitely have like the sniffles and we're not feeling good, but I have a hard time, especially this time of year, knowing, is it an allergy that's coming out because the weather has been warm and then freezing, or is it a cold? And is there a certain clue that when you can look at your child or look at yourself and say, okay, this is an allergy. This isn't a cold.
Yeah. Yeah. So a couple things. One, if your family gets it at the exact same time every year, that, you know, try to pay attention to trends that way. Number two, a cold, you know, you may have a little bit of a fever. You may have a little bit of sinus pain. You have the runny nose. And those are kind of like what you get with a cold. Allergies, you may have like itchy eyes, kind of like an itchy nose feeling. People may get those allergic shiners. They kind of look like they have kind of bluish, blackish eyes. Those tend to be more the allergy symptoms. They may get a little bit of a rash. So you can see like little bits and pieces to help differentiate it.
Okay, this is the final question. And I'm so curious because this is more of a fun question. It's a fun question.
I like it.
I would love to hear Dr. Daria's opinion on the keto diet that seems to be all the rage right now.
Yes.
Is it safe? Is it healthy? Like, what do you think about? Because it is. It's hot right now. The keto.
It's so hot. It's so hot. And you know, Jenna, like when I was writing this book, initially there were no diets in it because I don't want to tell people to diet. It's like a 4-letter word and it makes you miserable. Like literally, studies show that your stress levels go up when you diet. So what good is that? But I would give these talks and talk to people. And then at the end, no matter what I said about loving your body and things, there's always a question. I was like, so what diet should I use?
Right.
I was
like, paleo or a diet?
Right. Bye. So I like literally my book was about to go to press. I was like, guys, we're going to put in a diet. We're just going to do it because people want, and I understand. Yeah. And so I call it the Dr. Daria Restore Diet because my whole point with hacks is they kind of fall under big categories. One is how can I work with the way my body works? So if I can get a natural body cycle working so that I don't have to do the work myself because I can restore that equilibrium, great, check. That's one less decision I have to make. Number two is how can I change my environment so that the automatic decisions are healthy? Again, one less decision I have to make. That frees up a lot of brain space. So now I can be deliberate about the decisions I make and have just like a little bit of quiet time or time to connect with my family as well. So those are the three big categories just to make life easier and free up all that decision effort. So you've heard about intermittent fasting, right?
Yes. Yes.
So time-restricted eating is like its younger, cooler, hipper, more laid-back sibling.
Oh.
So, which appeals to me because I don't like things that make it feel like I'm having to work too hard. We have too much going on. So time-restricted eating says you fast, but you effectively fast for about 12 to 16 hours a day. And most of that fast is when you're sleeping. So it's kind of genius. You don't even notice that you're fasting. So they first did these studies in mice and found that even when mice are eating the same calories, those that eat them over a 15 or 24 hour cycle, like all day, versus those that eat them in a 9 to 12 hour window, those in the 9 to 12 hour window lost weight and their inflammatory markers went down. The others got chubby, even though they were eating the same calories. And you can even cheat a little bit on weekends. So what I tell people is, don't go crazy. It doesn't mean eat 15 pizzas in 9 hours. You want to eat still my trifecta that I tell you to eat, and you want to cut sugar. But if you do it within the time-restricted eating window of 9 to 12 hours, you do those three things together, you will find that you are losing weight and feeling good.
Okay, so now that I'm doing the math, I did – so there was at one point I was like 10 pounds overweight when I was in college, and it was my first time
ever. I can't imagine it.
No, but like and I'll tell you, now that I with every pregnancy I've gained about 60 pounds, I have a whole new appreciation for gaining and losing weight.
Yes.
Let me just say.
50 pounds with my babies. So I use these things to lose my own weight.
So, but one of the things I did is I wouldn't eat after 8 o'clock, and then I would eat again probably at 8 o'clock. So that's almost like a 12 hour.
Yeah.
So you're not talking about something crazy. It's just a boundary. We're not crazy yet.
We're crazy. So, but we're not advocating that in terms of eating. Let's be clear to all of our viewers. So exactly. And what I tell most people, and like, as you and I are talking about, there's a lot of non-moms and people who aren't parents at all who love this book. Aim for a minimum, keeping it to 12 hours, no more than eating in a 12 hour window. And on those days that you can go to 9 hours and then kind of be fasting a little bit longer, that's great. But you're not trying to, I find eating within 9 hours for me is really hard, especially with kids.
Yes. 100. Oh yeah. Those kids, man, they always kind of get in the way.
I know.
Okay. Final question for you. What is the hack that you learned writing the book? Like when you step away from this experience of writing, compiling all this information, your expertise, like kind of what is your takeaway? What did writing the book teach you that maybe was unexpected?
So, oh goodness. And you've read the book. So, there's some hacks that are just like super actionable. Do this now, you feel better right now. And then there are some that are a lot more conceptual. The resilience chapter was the hardest to write. And then it ended up being like the one that I loved the most. So, and I think probably because I needed every single hack in there. So I think kind of one of the things I work on a lot is that inner critic and learning to really look for the positive. Science teaches us that our brains are not fixed. Neuroplasticity shows that we can change our brains and that what we look for is what we see. So I have started to really work on that because we remember the negative stuff. We remember the negative comments or the rejections. You don't remember the good. So in my phone, I have a little good notes thing, a note section. When I get a compliment on my book or my daughter says I'm the best mommy in the world or whatever it is, I write it down. And you can do it either in the moment or at night. Take 30 seconds and write down three new things for which you're grateful or good things that happened that day. science shows us that when you do that, your brain starts, instead of scanning around for negative threats that are going to harm us, which is how it evolved evolutionarily, we start to look for the positive. And you start, again, what you look for is what you see. And it really has changed how I think about myself, how I speak to myself, and how I, you know, interact with the world around me.
That is amazing. I needed to hear that today. I'm going to have to go back and read that chapter. Is that the chapter? It's not the same one. Is it that there was the flood in the house?
That is. When I was crying in front of the electrician. Yeah, we got candid with that.
I had remember to that
do
chapter.
Something with that. Yes.
Yes. And now here it is. I don't want to spoil it for everyone, but it is a story that I was like, that would have been the day that I would have lost my mind. So we've all had a few of those. So thank you for channeling this into the Mom Hacks book. It's amazing. Highly recommend it. And thanks for taking our questions. This is fun. We should do it more often. What do you think?
Absolutely. Anytime. I love it.
Thanks, Dr. Yeah. Daria.
Thanks, and have a great day.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why, like you, he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. All so that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.